There are instances that are strange in the extreme. I have known people who are good-natured, even honest, and even respected by society, who yet could not with equanimity let a man go until he screamed out under the lash, till he prayed and implored for mercy. It was the duty of men under punishment to cry out and pray for mercy. That was the accepted thing. It was looked upon as necessary and proper. And when on one occasion the victim would not scream, the officer, whom I knew personally, and who might perhaps have been regarded in other respects as a good-natured man, took it as a personal insult. He had meant at first to let him off easily, but not hearing the usual, "Your Honour, Father, have mercy, I'll pray to God for you all my life," and the rest of it, he was furious, and gave the man 50 lashes extra, trying to wring cries and supplications out of him, and he succeeded in the end. "It couldn't be helped. The man was rude," he said to me, quite seriously. As for the actual executioner, who is not a free agent but acts under compulsion, he is, as everyone knows, a condemned convict who escapes his sentence by turning executioner. At first he learns his calling from another executioner, and when he has become an expert, he is attached permanently to the prison, where he lives apart in a special room, keeping house for himself, though he is almost always guarded. Of course, a live man is not a machine. Although the executioner beats as a duty, he sometimes grows keen on his work, but though the beating may give him some satisfaction, he scarcely ever feels personal hatred for his victim. His dexterity, his knowledge of his art, and his desire to show off before his fellow convicts and the public stimulate his vanity. He exerts himself for art's sake. Besides, he knows very well that he is an outcast, that he is met and followed everywhere by superstitious terror, and there is no saying that this may not have an influence on him, may not accentuate the ferocious and brutal tendencies within him. Even children know that he has disowned his father and mother. Strange to say, though, all the executioners I have seen have been men of some education, men of sense and intelligence, who had an extraordinary vanity, even pride. Whether this pride has been developed in them as a reaction to the general contempt felt for them, or whether it has been increased by the consciousness of the terror they inspire in their victim and the feeling of mastery over him, I do not know. Possibly the very ceremony and theatrical surroundings with which they make their appearance on the scaffold before the public help to develop a certain haughtiness in them. I remember that I once had the opportunity to meet an executioner frequently and closely observe him for some time. He was a thin, muscular man of 40, of medium stature, with a rather pleasant, intelligent face and a curly head. He was always extraordinarily calm and dignified, behaved like a gentleman, always answered briefly, sensibly, and even affably. But there was a haughtiness in his affability, as though he felt superior to me. The officers on duty often addressed him before me, and they positively showed him a sort of respect. He was conscious of this, and before the officers he redoubled his politeness, frigidity, and sense of personal dignity. The more friendly the officer was to him, the more unbending he became, and though he never departed from his refined courtesy, I am sure he felt himself at that moment infinitely superior to the officer who was addressing him. One could see this from his face. Sometimes, on hot summer days, he would be sent under guard with a long, thin pole to kill dogs in the town. There were an immense number of these dogs, who belonged to no one and multiplied with extraordinary rapidity. In hot weather they became dangerous, and by order of the authorities, the executioner was sent to destroy them. But even this degrading duty evidently did not in the least detract from his dignity. It was worth seeing the majesty with which he paced up and down the town, accompanied by the weary guard, scaring the women and children by his very appearance, and how calmly and even superciliously he looked at all who met him. The executioners have a very good time of it, though. They have plenty of money, they are very well fed, and have vodka to drink. They get money from bribes. The civilian prisoner who is condemned to corporal punishment always makes the executioner a preliminary present of something, even if it is his last penny. But from some rich prisoners, the executioner demands a sum suitable to the victim's supposed means. They will exact as much as 30 rubles, sometimes even more. They bargain dreadfully with very rich prisoners. But the executioner cannot punish a man very lightly. He would answer for it with his own back. For a certain sum, however, he will promise the victim not to chastise him very severely. The condemned men almost always agree to his terms, for if they don't, he really will punish them savagely, and it lies almost entirely in his hands. It sometimes happens that he demands a considerable ransom from a very poor prisoner. The relations come, bargain and bow down to him, and woe betide them if they do not satisfy him. In such cases, the superstitious terror he inspires is a great help to him. What wild stories are told about executioners! The convicts themselves assured me that an executioner can kill a man at one blow. But when has there been an instance of this? However, it may be so. They spoke of this with absolute confidence. The executioner assured me himself that he could do so. They told me, too, that he could aim a swinging blow at the convict's back in such a way that not the slightest bruise would follow, and the convict would feel no pain. But of all these tricks and subtleties, too many stories have already been told. But even if the executioner is bribed to let the victim off easily, he gives the first blow with all his might. That is invariably the habit. He softens the later blows, especially if he has received his payment. But whether he has been bought off or not, the first blow is his own affair. I really do not know why this is their custom, whether to prepare the victim for the later blows, on the theory that after a very bad one, the slighter ones will seem less painful, or whether simply to show off his power to his victim, to strike terror into him, to crush him at once, so that he may realize the sort of man he has to deal with, to display himself, in fact. In any case, the executioner is in a state of excitement before he begins his work. He feels his power. He is conscious of mastery. At that moment, he is an actor. The public gazes at him with wonder and alarm, and there is no doubt that he enjoys shouting to his victim at the first stroke, "Ready now! I'll scorch you!" The fatal and habitual phrase on these occasions. It is hard to imagine how far a man's nature may be distorted. During those early days in the hospital, I listened with interest to all these convict stories. It was very dull for us all, lying in bed. One day was so much like another. In the morning we were entertained by the visit of the doctors, and soon after that, dinner. Eating, of course, was a great recreation in the monotony of our existence. The rations were various, as prescribed for the different patients. Some of them only had soup with some cereal in it. Others only had porridge. Others were restricted to semolina pudding, for which there were always many candidates. The convicts had grown soft from lying in bed so long and were fond of dainties. The convalescent received a slice of boiled beef, bull, as they called it. Those who had scurvy were the best fed of all. They got beef with onion, horseradish and such things, and sometimes a glass of vodka. The bread, too, differed according to the patient's complaint. Some was black, while some was nearly white and was well-baked. This formality and precision in prescribing their diet only served to amuse the patients. Of course, some patients did not care to eat at all, but those who had an appetite ate whatever they liked. Some exchanged their rations so that the diet appropriate for one complaint was eaten by a patient suffering from something quite different. Others who were prescribed a bland diet bought the beef or the diet prescribed for the scurvy, drank kvass or the hospital beer, buying it from those to whom it was prescribed. Some individuals even consumed the rations of two. The plates of food were sold and resold for money. A helping of beef was priced rather high. It cost 5 farthings. If there was none to sell in our ward, we used to send the attendant to the other convict ward, and if we could not get it there, we would send to the soldiers, or free ward, as it was called. Patients who wanted to sell it could always be found. They were left with nothing but bread, but they made money. Poverty, of course, was universal, but those who had money sent to market for rolls and even sweet things. Our attendants carried out all these commissions quite disinterestedly. After dinner was the dreariest time. Some of us, bored with nothing to do, fell asleep, while some were gossiping, others were quarrelling, others were telling stories. If no fresh patients were brought in, it was even duller. A new arrival almost always made some sensation, especially if no one knew him. The patients scrutinized him, tried to find out who and what he was, where he came from, and what brought him there. They were particularly interested in those who were being forwarded to other prisons. These always had something to tell, though not, as a rule, about their personal life. If they did not speak of that of their own accord, they were never questioned about it, but were only asked where they had come from, with whom. Some were at once reminded by their account of something in their own past, and told of different journeys, parties, and the officers in charge of them.